The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at an historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laugh as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
What's up? This your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. This is part two of a special series on fonts that a lot of people hate. Please listen to part one, where you can hear some vim and vinegar, not only from our super producer, Mr. Max Williams, but from Mr. Noel Brown and from me as well. They call me Ben. Noel, You remember how in a different show we talked a bit about the frequency illusion, which is when you hear a word and all of a sudden you feel like you hear that word all the time, or you buy a car and you feel like you see that car all the time.
What's the name of that? There's a name for that phenomenon.
Is it
Bader-Meinhof?
Bader-Meinhof, right? Yeah. That's just so. It's Bader-Meinhof. And sometimes called frequency illusion. And that happened to me with papyrus. After part one of our fonts episode, I remember thinking, wow, papyrus is everywhere, and it really does seem to damage the credibility of what's being communicated.
Were you compelled to go and watch the Avatar films after that?
I was not. I was. It's funny because on another show we do called Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, we recently recorded an episode about a mysterious bridge in Scotland called the Dog Suicide Bridge. And I didn't mention that on that show, and I probably won't, but the one book that is written about it is leans more into supernatural explanations. And folks, the cover font is in papyrus.
No, it's not.
It is.
That I still read it. Self-published. Does that not just scream self-published, though?
Yeah, I know, but yeah, you know, research is important, so I had to do the due diligence of reading it.
Of course.
But we, in the interim, folks, we found so many other strange fonts, such that we might have to return in another installment to talk about controversial fonts in non-Western languages. But for now, with some help from our research associate, Jeff Bartlett, I don't know, man. Let's dive into Times New Roman.
Why not? Times New Roman, indeed. This is a font. We kind of talked about some of the more, let's call them credible fonts, you know, Helvetica came up as sort of like a end-all be-all for designers in terms of just the right amount of thinning of the joints between the letters and all of that stuff, just the right amount of serif for lack of serif and all that. And Times New Roman sort of has earned, I guess, itself a place in the history of fonts. It's a little bit divisive because it's sort of what you would consider like a templatized sort of standard font. And for that reason alone, I think it may have also earned itself a bit of a place on the shit list, let's call it, you know, of fonts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, and also we talked about kerning in part one, but I don't think we defined it. Kerning is the way spacing between characters works. The Times New Roman dates back to the original Roman type in 1470. This guy named Nicholas Jensen creates Roman type, and he is inspired by the text on ancient Roman buildings. Mm-hmm. And it catches on pretty quickly. Chances are, if you pull up a word processor, whether that's Microsoft Word or what have you, you're probably going to look at Times New Roman rather than Roman type, which you don't see so much today.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a font that that does a really good job of displaying Roman numerals for good reason, you know? I mean, it really is that kind of traditional, the kind of font that you might think of as being etched, you know, the product of some sort of artisanal stone cutting. And as we said, this font has historically been kind of the standard, you know, set font for word processors, you know, like Microsoft Word or Notepad or whatever. It's the kind of the one that comes up by default. But it actually started with a bit of a spirit of competition, sort of similar, similar but very different to the story behind Comic Sans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's a real hold my beer moment in the history of typeface. There's this guy, Stanley Morrison. He's already got his bona fides. He is an esteemed type designer. And he starts a beef with the famous London newspaper, The Times. And he says, look, you all are a bunch of stuffed shirts. You're elitist. You're out of touch with the modern typographical trends, which, you know, to be fair, most of the public probably didn't care about. So The Times says, okay, Stan, you talk so big, why don't you make something better? And he says, well, I will. He gets a draftsman named Victor Lardent to start brainstorming with him, and they land on two goals. We're going to be efficient and we're going to be easy on the eyes. Efficient meaning we're going to maximize the amount of type, the number of characters you can fit on a line, and we're also going to make it easier to read. We're getting a lot of this from a great article on NYPL.org by Meredith Mann called Where Did Times New Roman Come From? And it's, you know, London Times New Roman. He was petty enough that he put the name of the paper in the name of the font.
So in 1926, the British Medical Research Council published a report diving into the legibility of print and, you know, how this affects readers. And they issued some guidelines or some recommendations, right, for what would achieve maximum legibility. And Times New Roman attempted to really, you know, adhere to these guidelines. There were some test pages that were submitted to what is referred to in the article that you cited, Ben, as a distinguished ophthalmic authority, right? And so then it became, you know, once they kind of got the thumbs up from said distinguished ophthalmic authority, they were able to kind of issue almost like a 3 out of 4 doctors agree, you know, Times New Roman is easy on the eyes.
Yeah, it's for your health. And they said, okay, we've got some credibility. We've got scientific analysis. That's pretty good. But we need to see, we need to drive this around the block, essentially. We need to see how it works when you actually read it. So members for this team, the Report on the Legibility of Print team, spent a long time reading this, and they case tested it. They read it out during nice afternoons in the sunlight. They read it under artificial light. They tested and tested and tested again, and they finally approved it. They called it the Times New Roman, and on October 3rd, 1932, the Times had their big reveal. They debuted it, and all of the readers of the paper, the Times, were reminded daily of the importance of type and printing. At least that's according to the Monotype Recorder, which, as you can tell, might be a bit of a biased source. Oh, this was also the first time ever that a newspaper designed its own typeface.
Right, and that's a big deal because, as we know, you know, the history of typography is one that kind of begins with actual typesetting and, you know, creating these sets of letters and characters that were designed by, you know, specific individuals that worked at printing presses. So typically the printing press was sort of separate from the publishing or the content creation, right, of the news. So this really was kind of a big deal. This means, though, that the Times actually owned this font, and they had exclusive rights to it, but only for a year, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. How does that work, Ben? Is this like, why was there such a clock put on it as opposed to what would normally be a longer period for copywriting or trademarking of something?
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing it's someone with patent laws, but it's like, you know, how quickly does it become kind of universal like thing? That's kind of a lot of times how that stuff goes. Like I know with trademarks or stuff like that, especially on like brand names, once it becomes universal, like calling something a search engine, Googling it is like an example of that.
Sure,
like
proprietary eponym would be.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough to know for sure. We can speculate on a couple of things. One, it may have been part of the agreement the Times pitched. Two, it may have been part of the negotiations between Stanley and the Times, because he might have known he had lightning in a bottle, and the price that they would have to pay for exclusivity may have been pretty prohibitive. But also, to your point, Max, it would be difficult to enforce rights after a certain amount of time, but it turned out they didn't really have a lot to worry about in terms of exclusivity for the immediate future, because after those rights lapse, publishers over in the United States, especially newspaper publishers, aren't champing at the bit. And it is champing at the bit, not chomping. They're not champing at the bit to adopt this new font because they're being cheapskates. It needs more ink and it needs a better quality of paper. And so essentially the William Randolph Hearst of the world across the pond are saying, no, we're not, nah, pass. So we see Times New Roman come out not first in newspapers in the U.S., but in books and magazines, notably Woman's Home Companion in December 1941.
Precisely. So you're starting to see this wide adoption of this font, which is a big deal. And a lot of this stems from the fact that it really was incredibly legible, you know, and in small print. As we know, newspapers and magazines are trying their best to shove as much content into as small a space as possible to maximize what they can, you know, put in their publications, the amount of stuff that they can cover. So this was a big deal. This is still a time where this is not a computerized process at all. You know, this is in the 1940s and 50s where these, you know, typesets were still part of the process of printing, you know, physical metal letters and characters. There was something called punches, mm-hmm. That actually helped create the molds for casting these types. And they were created by a company called the Monotype Corporation. And they collaborated with the Linotype Company. And I believe Monotype and Linotype are still, you know, names that resonate within the typography community to this day. These were manufacturers of machines that would do typesetting. So they really were very, very important organizations, you know, for creating mass-produced media. Both companies made sets of these letters that were available for purchase. The monotype version was known as Times New Roman. The linotype version was just Times Roman. So if we move forward a little bit, quite a bit actually, into the, I guess, more like the 80s, into the computer era, where we start to see selectable fonts being used in word processing programs, like, you know, those created by Apple computers. Because remember, early on, before computers could do all of the crazy things that we know and love today, they were essentially bespoke typewriters, you know? So Apple licensed the Linotype version, and Microsoft licensed the Monotype version. That is why the way the appearance of these fonts to this day, between Apple and Windows machines, look a little bit different.
Max, can I get a more, you know? Close enough to not get a suit. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
That's a true story. It's a weird historical footnote. We should also footnote that the Times was not super on board with people using their font in books, in any long-form writing. They said, quote, "It is a newspaper type and hardly a book type, for it is strictly appointed for use in short lines, i.e. in columns." And they went back and later developed a wider version of Times New Roman to fit the longer lines of text in a book. And the idea that the use of a typeface affects its form struck our writer, Mann, that we mentioned earlier, as incredibly relevant still in the modern day. You know, a lot of books are entirely published electronically. A lot of the stuff that the average person reads is not a book. It's an article on the phone. It's an article on a web page somewhere. And that's why the ideas that Stanley had originally, efficiency and ease of reading, right? These are still incredibly crucial today. That's why you see the newer kids on the printing block. No, keep it.
It's kept. It's
folks like Ariel and Calibri. How do you guys pronounce it?
I guess maybe Calibri. Calibri sounds good. I think it's potato.
Your pronunciation sounds better than how I've ever said it.
How do you say it?
I don't know.
Calibri. You say a Calibri with like four eyes at the end?
I see it selected and I immediately change it.
There you go. Okay. All right. So these typefaces are quite competitive nowadays because if you're reading on a screen, the lack of serifs, remember our technical definition from part one, serifs are those little dealy bops at the end.
Yeah.
At the end of streets.
The little dongles, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. the little hangers.
Yeah. The little weenus bumps there. If you don't have serifs, then for most people, it's easier to read a word on a screen. But Times New Roman is almost a century old, and it made the jump from print to digital. I think maybe Noel, we talk about the idea that fonts without serifs are easier to read. Why is that? Or do we have any specifics on that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the idea being that I think it's just a little bit less distracting. It is a little faster to process sans serif fonts, you know, like you mentioned, stuff like Tahoma, Verdana, Arial. And Paula Peters on Medium points out that, you know, these days we're kind of blasting through text. You know, the average viewer or the average reader only spends about 11 seconds reading an email and around 60 seconds reading a 20-page proposal of some sort. She cites sales proposals. So, you know, since we're kind of living in a culture of scanning, the more legible, the better. But as we mentioned at the top of the show, I think Times New Roman, while very effective at communicating because of its wide adoption in books, you know, magazines, newspapers, publications of all kinds, because of this study that we talked about that cited its incredible legibility, I think people just got bored with it, you know, like anything that you kind of get inundated with. So while it was an effective tool, you know, and accomplished exactly what it was set out to do, when you start getting into like design communities and folks that are maybe looking to have things, you know, have a little bit more of an aesthetic flair, it starts to become so overly recognizable to the point of being cliche.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, another comparison would be the fashion of business suits, right? Like double-breasted suits, when you see them, you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. They scream 70s, 80s. They're still a suit. They're still the reason that person is not naked in front of you. They get the job done. But, you know, there's something aesthetic about it. And this leads Paula Peters to say that modern audiences love a font without a serif. If you pay attention, you'll start seeing this everywhere. We don't want to get in your head too far, folks, but look around. Odds are you will not be far away from something written, right? And if you are reading a Latin-based language, then you are probably going to notice there's a lack of serif in most of the things you're seeing now. Serif fonts are easy to read if you have a really big monitor. You know what I mean? Like if you play World of Warcraft and you're reading something on that same monitor, Times New Roman, chef kiss, beautiful. But if you're reading on a mobile phone, like so many people these days, then you're going to see that it's a little bit more difficult. And as Peters points out, nowadays, almost 62% of all emails are opened on a smartphone. And if you look at the millennial generation in particular, which we are a part, then you'll see that number goes up to 88%. No one tell our bosses, but a lot of times, a lot of times we're like in bed or we're walking somewhere.
Sure.
Yeah.
Multitasking, or, yeah, you know, listening to other stuff.
Yeah.
Perhaps watch researching on a computer while looking at emails on the phone, right. You know, all of that stuff.
And they were writing on the phone.
100%. It's definitely part of the equation for sure. I think one of the biggest issues, though, is just the kind of dated vibe of Times New Roman and what it communicates about your brand or your company, you know, as like philosophically speaking, you know, everyone kind of no one wants to be considered old fashioned nowadays. Like, everyone wants to feel like they're in some way on the cutting edge, and design is a big part of that. You know, like you said, the medium is the message. So what you put out there, whether it be your style guide for communications within a company, you know, your signature file, for example, companies even like ours have a very stylized and uniform way of formatting those signature files, including the font choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you, for instance, think about it this way. If you are considering putting money into a new or bleeding edge industry and you go to their website and it's in Times New Roman, then you're going to think, they don't get it. I don't know if these are the people I trust for this investment. So we have to be conscious of this. You know, it's often said by great communicators that how you say something matters as much as what you are saying, right? A great deal of information in in-person conversations is conveyed via intonation and body language, which is why it's easy to misread a text, right? The same holds true with fonts to some degree. The font you choose will influence the way your message is interpreted by the readers. And that's why you see things like multiple graphic designers have written their own diatribes, dare I say, manifestos about Times New Roman. They say things like, it's corny and boring, avoid it when you can. It's bad. It's ugly. One person said, it makes me nervous when I see it.
Yeah. Here we are. Here we are with the poster out. You know, the reviews are in for Times New Roman, like we did with Comic Sans. Again, yeah, I mean, especially when you're looking at things through the lens of a designer, this is something that's absolutely going to make them cringe for all the reasons we outlined. It's dated. It's not maybe as easy to read as some kind of updated versions of the quote-unquote more legible fonts, and it really does say a lot about kind of your attitude towards aesthetics and towards kind of being seen as a little bit more on the cutting edge.
Which led some people to say, I want a font that makes an impact. Hey, yeah. So,
impact.
Yeah. Sunday.
Exactly. Impact being like one of the more aggressive fonts.
Yeah.
It's a font that you want, a font that smacks you in the head like a stack of bricks. Impact is for you.
Impact, invented in 1965 by Jeffrey Lee. It is easy to read. It is sans serif. It does grab your attention, but it is, in the world of design, people think it's often a little too thin in the strokes. It's amateurish. It's most commonly used on documents that have been, quote, designed by people who don't know what they're doing when it comes to typefaces. And as such, it should be avoided. That is coming to us from VandalayDesign.com in an article by designer Stephen Snell.
Exactly. It's the kind of font that you might see if you highlight something in a, like, let's say you're using notes, like on an iPhone, and then you highlight it and just select heading.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's going to present you with. Something with kind of a large amount of space in between the letters, which arguably does make it a little easier to read, and a kind of inherent boldness to it. But again, it's just a little bit cliche, you know? It's like sort of almost mimicking the headlines of yesteryear in the same way that Comic Sans was trying to mimic the way text was designed for speech bubbles in cartoons.
Yeah, exactly. And imagine reading an official government document or a paper of note in Impact font. After the headline, you make a great point about the headline. After the headline, it would start to feel off somehow. Jeffrey Lee designed this font because he was in the midst of the 1960s, and the mid-1960s, as we know, experienced a renaissance for bold, condensed typefaces that, according to designers, probably came about through other cut-up prints and art of the day, specifically something called the Schmalfett Grotesque font, which had been drawn by Walter Hattenschweiler. And because Impact was less condensed than this other font, to your point about kerning, designers often use these two fonts together. and you could use impact for, you know, impact.
Yeah, maximum. I love the idea of a font being grotesque, though. I think some designers might consider all of these fonts that we're talking about, you know, in these episodes to be grotesque. Shout out to Schmalfett.
Yes, shout out to Schmalfett. And developers, oh, here's where you see impact the most. Nowadays, fellow Ridiculous Historians, you see it in memes. It's the default font for things like Caption Meme. It's the default font for a lot of those macros you can make your own. And developers use Impact because it's super readable. It's ubiquitous. It's available on every computer. You don't have to download a new font pack. And you don't have to read a lot for a meme, usually, right? A meme is I don't want to sound pretentious. You can hate or love memes, or as they're called sometimes, shit post. But you have to admit, there's an art and a beauty to the economy of language.
No question. And, you know, as is the case for a lot of internet culture, you know, and kind of like stuff that might have found its origins on forums, you know, like Something Awful or Penny Arcade or some of these, you know, forums that sort of kind of got condensed into now what we know as Reddit, I guess. I mean, all these other, there are, of course, forums that still exist that are more under the radar, but now Reddit has kind of become the more like mainstreamed version of a lot of this type of internet communication. Dated fonts and kind of, you know, internet relics are like a big part of the presentation for these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And our pal, Jeff Bartlett, not Jeffrey Lee, Jeff Bartlett, research associate, wants everyone to know that he has only one tattoo, and it is Sapere Aude, Latin for dare to know, and an old school like motto of the Age of Enlightenment, says it's on his forearm. It is in Impact font, and he has no regrets.
All right. You heard it here first. Oh, man. It's I'm so excited. Yeah. I'm so excited for this next one. We've been teasing it from the start. Good old Papyrus.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Mother's Day is coming, and mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
you know, if we're talking about fonts that are trying to invoke a certain feeling, you know, a certain, like, you know, we said Comic Sans was trying to evoke whimsy or sort of creativity or, you know, like a lightness to your communications. I'm not quite sure what Papyrus is supposed to communicate in that respect. Is it mysticism?
Yeah.
Is it the age, the wisdom of the ancients?
It's like you're reading a scroll, you know. Max, give us some like D&D Renaissance festival music, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, what I mean by D&D, not Do Not Disturb. So here's our intro, maybe a fife, a flute, a bit of a lute. There's an American, his name's Chris Costello. He creates Papyrus in 1983. This is also, this reminds me, I associate Papyrus with the early, the early computer games I used to play by Sierra Entertainment. So shout out to anyone who remembers King's Quest. But Chris says, this is one of my proudest accomplishments. He's also, Chris has his stripes. He's a graphic designer, illustrator, web designer. And he says, similar to the creation of Comic Sans, he says that Papyrus was made with certain intent, and it was never meant to be used on the logos of big businesses, on mortgage companies, construction logos, just like our Times New Roman example. You wouldn't trust, say, a cryptocurrency outfit that had their website in Times New Roman. Would you trust a mortgage company in Papyrus? Like, their font is in Papyrus?
I wouldn't trust a mortgage company, no matter what their font was in. No, definitely not. Or perhaps a realtor, you know, whose yard signs have their name emblazoned in Papyrus. Yeah, it has kind of taken on the reputation of being the most maligned font on the planet.
Yeah, the Pepsi to the Coca-Cola of Comic Sans. Papyrus is famous for being misused. You see it in business cards, letterheads, signs, etc. There are a lot of websites that exist just to make fun of Papyrus. It gets featured ironically in all kinds of things, in television shows, in sketch comedy, if you want to sort of undercut the character who is being cartoonish in the sketch, then you have them, without explanation, use Papyrus. And shout out to that SNL sketch we mentioned. Shout out to the McSweeney's article, which I'd love to read in full. The Comic Sans article is just, it's so good. Anyway, Chris Costello sold the rights to his font, and he regrets it a little bit. He says, there have definitely been days I wish I'd never sold the rights, and I get that there are a lot of critics. But hate if you must. Papyrus is on over a billion computers around the world. It's a font you can choose right now.
You can definitely choose it. As we saw, a designer choosing it from the list of available fonts in that amazing SNL short about, you know, Papyrus being the logo for Avatar, a multi-billion-dollar grossing, you know, fantasy science fiction franchise. Watch that if you get a chance with Ryan Gosling. It puts a lot of context around this. But, you know, if you look at the font, though, on its own, and you saw it, like, as a singular work, maybe before the ubiquity of it, like on the cover of a comic book or something, it does evoke kind of like a biblical kind of Middle Eastern mystical kind of vibe, you know, and that's exactly what Costello was trying to do when he was messing around with a calligraphy pen on a literal piece of parchment paper. And he, you know, was kind of fooling around and created these sort of ornate sort of capital letters that had these brush strokes or kind of pen strokes, you know, on the edges. And he also claims that he got to this place because he was on a bit of a biblical journey himself.
Reading a lot of history, spiritual and geographical, about the Middle East. And then he also said he dove into the biblical times. That's a quote from him. And he was drawing a lot of ligatures and letters with these hairline arrangements. And this struck a chord internally for Chris Costello. And over the course of just a few days, he worked on these letters until he had generated an entire Roman alphabet in all caps. And he was pretty happy with it. he said, you know what? I'm going to call this papyrus. I'm going to see if I can turn it into a font and get this, ridiculous historians. This was the very first typeface he ever worked on. This is a lot like going into a studio and saying, I play a little guitar. I've never recorded anything. And then boom, you've created, you know, what's a hated pop song? Macarena, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe, you know, let's say the instrument was maybe more of like a cowbell or something, right? You make the most noted cowbell song of all time, right? That then becomes something of a trope.
And the thing is, he sent this out and he wanted to sell it. And he said, everybody rejected me. The big names, the small names, and type distribution, which is an industry, honestly, folks, I had never thought about. Until he talks to one company, a small outfit called Letraset, British company, and he believes they may have been the creators of Lorem Ipsum. And you guys know, everybody knows Lorem Ipsum, right? It's the famous placeholder text.
Well, that, yeah, or like whenever a font is missing, right?
Or the,
isn't that what comes up by default?
The content, yeah. It's like a mock-up.
Oh, no, it's to demonstrate.
Yeah.
It's to demonstrate a font because I think it has, or it's sort of like the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. I think it demonstrates a good number of characters in a font set. Ooh. So it's used to kind of showcase, like, you know, the letters, the style of the letters in a particular font set.
The eye feel. Yeah. That makes sense, right? How do my eyes feel looking at this in this font? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's smart too. So, like Comic Sans, if there's a villain in the story for people who hate Comic Sans and Papyrus, then it's Microsoft, right? Because those fonts may not have caught on if they weren't pre-installed on Microsoft Office, starting with Office 97. Actually, behind the scenes, I don't know if we want to keep this in, but I was looking through the fonts on the shared docs we use,
mm-hmm.
and I was going to see if I could put it in Papyrus, but I decided not. We've got a show to do.
Well, that's the thing, though, right? Like, it's no longer that, you know, ubiquitously pre-installed font that it used to be. And a lot of the history that we're talking about has exactly to do with what you're saying. You know, you have like a sort of tastemaker, like a company like Microsoft that determines what goes on these machines that are widely adopted. And then it's ultimately up to creators to kind of proliferate which fonts become the thing, you know? But then they sort of create the palette, set the tones that were available to designers and obviously non-designers alike. Not to mention, remember back in the day when like web pages would be in weird fonts, you know?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And but you were limited to what fonts were installed, whether you were a Mac user or a PC user. And now web pages and various designs don't necessarily depend on you having that font installed unless you want to actually create something. You know, if things are generated into like vector images or whatever, you know, like high quality JPEGs, you don't have to have that font installed. So you can get all kinds of design elements that don't rely on the user having that. But back in the day, it was literally sourcing what fonts you had on your computer and then recreating that with those characters that were actually installed on your physical machine. So yeah, I mean, Microsoft Office starting in 97, like you said, is really to blame. For at the very least, giving folks the options that some of which became these hated fonts.
Yeah, yeah, you nailed it, man. And it's strange because none of these font creators, these designers, they're not bad guys. They're not Bond-level villains. They made something really cool, and it's just in the way people used it. Now, of course, when you're learning about the creator of Papyrus, if you hate Papyrus, you may be tempted to think of this guy as some kind of Bond-level graphic design supervillain. But believe it or not, folks, he only got the equivalent of about $2,500 for selling the rights. So he probably lost out on millions of dollars, given that 1 in 7 people on the planet has access to Papyrus on their computer.
But that's the thing, too. You know, a font, that comes pre-installed like that is sort of like having back to our discussion on sampling, you know, not the cheese cubes, but like sampling of music. You know, if you buy a keyboard, like a synthesizer or a, you know, a sampler or whatever, and it has presets on it, those are available to be used without concern over copyright clearance.
Good point.
So the idea of who's making money off of Papyrus, the answer is probably no one, really. You know, after that initial deal, you know, selling the rights to it, then it sort of gets lumped in with this list of presets. As we know, fancier font sets are quite expensive because you are paying for the rights to be able to use that font in whatever commercial designs you might, you know, want to use it in. But since Papyrus is already pre-installed on your system and it comes with, quote unquote, you know, your software that you already have, you can use it however you want. So it's not like every time someone, you know, I don't think that anyone got paid for Papyrus being used in the Avatar logo. I would also argue that it's possible, I don't know specifically, but that the version of Papyrus on the Avatar logo was adjusted or tweaked in some way. You can make tweaks to like font sets and stuff and then kind of make it your own. But I don't know, Max, what do you think? Like, do you think if someone is using one of these fonts, is there anyone getting a check? Are there like font residuals?
I'd like to answer as well after you, Max.
Yeah, probably, maybe. But to the thing is, like, if you make it just slightly different? So, side note, I watched the Papyrus sketch right before we came on. Mm-hmm. And in it, Chris Redd is playing, I guess, Ryan Gosling's friend. And he's like, hey, man, it might have started with Papyrus, but it's just like slightly different. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm guessing that's probably a tricky thing where if you make it just different enough, and it's probably just very much soaked in minutia.
Sure. So. Yeah. I also like to think that maybe their budget was just so close that they said, we have to use one of the pre-installed fonts. It's down between Papyrus and Comic Sans. But, you know, shout out to Costello, who sounds like a really cool guy. He says, I'm not embarrassed about this. You know, the fact that it's one of the world's most widely recognizable fonts, even if that means it's overused, it means there's just as many people out there who love it as who hate it. And he also says, stay humble. I mean, Chris feels like a good guy to hang out with, you guys. He also says, telling people I created Papyrus is always a good topic for humorous conversation. It always gets a laugh. How can you put a price on that? That's nice, man. That's very well adjusted, I think.
Excellent conversation starter. Mm-hmm. For sure. You know, what an interesting claim to fame. I mean, did this guy go on to design any other fonts? This is his first one out the gate, right? Did he try to, repair his reputation? I mean, not that he feels like it's a bad reputation, but, you know, it seemed like he was just sort of a dabbler in font design. I got to wonder, like, is this guy, what's he up to now?
He's got a website, chriscostello.design, and you can see his collection of fonts, which include Blackstone. He also has Mirage, Letterpress Text, and Papyrus. And then he has one called Virus. This is a rabbit hole to look into. And I think we've hit some of the big ones. Noel, we'll doubtlessly hear from our fellow ridiculous historians who have pet peeve fonts of their own. But I believe we have to mention just at least the once. We have to mention how Wingdings came about. As we're wrapping up this series, Wingdings is the thing that looks like a bunch of strange nonsense. You know, it looks like the computer has taken over and it doesn't speak your language. Mm-hmm. But according to a great article by Phil Edwards over in Vox, why the Wingdings font exists, there are multiple versions of Wingdings. It's one of like the early days of emoji. It could give you an image and scale it.
Yeah, or at the very least, like clip art, right? Like it was a way, I think we talked about this a little bit in the last episode, that it was, yeah, to your point, fonts are also scalable. That's a very important distinction that you made there, Ben, because you can blow up a font to a massive size and it's not going to have any pixelation, right? I mean, depending on, you know, how you are outputting it, like in whatever, you know, design software you're using. But a font is essentially like information telling a computer how to recreate something that is scalable, whether it's tiny or whether it's massive. It's not the same as like blowing up a low resolution JPEG, which of course is going to cause all kinds of, you know, horrible blurring and pixelation and all that. This is neat because these are little individual images. Some of the ones that they pull on the Vox article are like a little hand or a little disk drive, you know, or like a floppy disk. Some of them are just little symbols like an X, you know, or in a circle, or, you know, certain kind of characters that might be look like runes or something like that, right? There were multiple iterations of Wingdings as well. We had the OG Wingdings, which would have like, you know, there's like a ohm symbol in there. There's, you know, like a little reticle or whatever you call it, sort of like the way the Zodiac Killer signed, you know, his missives to the press. Then you had Wingdings 2, Wingdings 3. Then, of course, who could forget Webdings? And then something called Zap Ding Bats, mm-hmm. which I'm not familiar with, but that's where you start. They do start to resemble like the emojis that we know today, like a peace sign, explosions, like a little, you know, kind of a firecracker pop, or things like snowflakes.
Mm-hmm. And of course, flowers. Charles Bigelow, who's one of the co-creators of Wingdings in its various forms, says that his personal favorite will be the floral designs. And we wanted to squeeze in just a little explanation about Wingdings. What a ride this has been. We may have to return to fonts in the future because this addresses so many things that we find ridiculous about history, right? Social dynamics, human psychology, how small things can have such an outsized influence. Had a great time with this one. And thanks to super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Thanks to research associate Jeff, I didn't know about the impact tattoo.
Oh, I didn't either. And I just have to add one last little thing because I questioned what the deal was with wing ding bats. Apparently, ding bats actually refer to a particular type of tool that was used in printing. Mm-hmm. They were small pieces of reusable shapes that could be slotted into text and used like to kind of add a little bit of flair to a book printing. Think about maybe something that might be used in chapter headings or even like page numbers or little kind of bespoke like frames on the edge of pages, things like that. They were called dingbats. So, you know, the more you know. I love how a lot of this stuff or most of this stuff does have references to, you know, antiquity and to like the age that's even pre-printing press. And then obviously the printing press becomes the earliest form of typesetting. And then it, you know, transitions into the computer age. So yeah, no, I'm with you, man. This is a really, really fun topic. And I don't know, some of these fonts, I think maybe are a little unfairly maligned. I don't hate Comic Sans maybe as much as the design community might. None of these really inspire that much like ire from me personally. I'm more interested in the history and the question of like why certain people hate these. So I hope we did a decent job in answering those.
I don't know if y'all have noticed this, but I have been returning emails in Comic Sans since
I see. Last part. Yeah, I saw it. And also, thanks to you guys for letting me include what was going to be a Wingdings diatribe. But after I had found and read that Vox article, I just really enjoyed the history of it, like you guys are saying. And thanks, of course, to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister, Christopher Hasiotis, here in spirit, Eve's Jeffcoat, Gabe Lousier, who is killing it over on This Day in History class.
Mm-hmm. And of course, research associate extraordinaire Jeff Bartlett. Thank you for being our Sherpa on this font journey. And you, Ben, it's been a wild ride.
Mm-hmm. Sans serif all the way.
We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today.
Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.